And welcome back to Dads on the Air, coming to you around Australia on the Community Radio Network. In this program, we bring you informing and entertaining conversations with a wide range of interesting people on topics of fatherhood, family and parenting, and men's and boys' issues, and more. Hi, I'm Bill Cable, and our special guest today is Mike Allsop, and we are set for adventure. Mike is an adventurer. He is an airline pilot with Air New Zealand, a mountaineer, and a man who has done the 777, seven marathons, seven continents in 7 days. He's also done the world's highest marathon run. Most importantly, Mike is a father, and his new book is called High Adventure. The adventure doesn't end when you become a dad. Mike, welcome to Dads on the Air.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
So, Mike, with your experience, do you see some similarities between being a leader at high altitude and parenting?
That's a good question. I've been asked that question before. Yes, because it's unpredictable. And I think as a parent, we all go through high points and low points. So, yes, there is. And I think, I suppose, the better leader I become, the less I say. So, I suppose with parenting, especially with teens, the less you say sometimes is a little bit better.
Well, I hate to bring it up, but at one point there were some little white lies you told to your daughter about... I think there were some goats about to be slaughtered, so you made up on the spot a very good story, I thought.
Yes, no, there was. We came in a corner and there was 50 cute goats, and they're all super friendly. This is in the Himalayas, and she looked and said, "Where are they going?" Into the Sherpa, and he said, "Oh, they're going to slaughter." And I said very quickly, "That's a little village just around the corner."
And it worked. Well, I guess there are some of those when you're leading high-altitude groups as well.
Oh, yes, sometimes. They ask you how far it is and how long to go, and you have to tell a little white lie sometimes and tell them it's just around the corner to keep their spirits high.
Now, to some degree, I think we all learn about parenting on the run, but in your own case, sadly, you were prevented from having your father in your life. Do you think a lot of your adventuring is perhaps a reaction to missing out on that in your youth?
I don't know. I think in some ways, yes, but it's hard for me to put my finger on it. I think, when my dad sort of left for whatever reason he did when he was 10, and I think him and my mother were fighting, and he didn't want us seeing that, so he thought it was better not to be in our lives, which is pretty sad. So I think in some ways it made me more determined to be a better father myself, because things have a tendency to repeat themselves. Bad fathers produce bad fathers sometimes, and I didn't really want, not that he's a bad father, it's probably a poor choice of words, but that I didn't want to repeat history to repeat itself. So I went along and I found, I got some help from a little company called Parents Inc., called The Parenting Place now, and I read some books about being a father, and there's a couple of things that really stuck out for me when I was reading those books.
And what were they? Do you remember the important things that for you?
Oh, absolutely. So the biggest one was children spelled love, T-I-M-E, just time. Mm. It doesn't have to be going to the Himalayas. It doesn't have to be going up Kilimanjaro with your teenager. It can be just spending time with them. I drive my kids to school, and that's what I do. No matter what time I finish at night or early in the morning, I get up, drive them to school, and that's our time, just one-on-one, and then they take it in turns. And then I go on these adventures with them. The other thing is I really liked, they talked in this little book, it's called Fathers Who Dare Win. It's a tiny little pocketbook, and they talk about having family traditions. It can be anything. So, for example, so we have a family tradition at 7 years of age, you've got to come and see Mount Everest with Dad. It was a rite of passage, it was compulsory, and they all loved it. And then we have other traditions that we talk about in the book. But one of them can be, on New Year's Eve, I don't sleep inside, I sleep outside. Under the stars every New Year's, and it's sort of a bit of a dedication to some friends that I lost in the mountains on New Year's Eve, sort of 20 years ago. But that's turned into a family tradition. Now all the kids, no matter where we are, we all sleep outside New Year's Eve, rain, hail or shine.
I'm Totally in favour of that. It sounds great. A lot of fun. And look, a lot of fathers find it hard to tell their kids that they're proud of them and that they love them. I'm guessing you don't find that difficult at all.
It's just part of my everyday language, I suppose. You know, sometimes, I mean, kids are frustrating sometimes, let's face it. And so, but I try and as hard as I can to focus on the good points and focus on what they're doing really well. And I think as a pilot, especially, you know, in the old days when I was doing a bit of instructing, we had a thing where you'd bring, you know, if you're giving feedback or you'd bring people up, you'd bring them down, then you bring them up. So you tell them something really good that they've done, then you put in your constructive criticism that you need to tell them, and then that's the kept bringing them down a little bit, and then you bring them back up and leave things on a positive note. So, yeah, I mean, kids respond really well to speaking to them really, really positively.
When you finally saw your own father again, I think it was about 26 years between your time together. Did you get any sense from him that he was proud of all you'd achieved?
Well, he did say that, but, you know, the other thing, and he said it, you know, I'm really proud of you, et cetera, and I was just about to leave for Everest, and I'll catch you when you get back, and we never caught up again. So that was quite sad on both our parts as well, but, I mean, actions speak louder than words, you know. It's all very well, especially as an adult, saying something, but you've got to back it up with action.
Well, when you were growing up, have you always set goals for yourself? I mean, I don't know whether climbing Everest was in your an initial goal, but have you always been setting little goals for yourself along the way?
Well, yes. So, I mean, it all started when I wanted to be an airline pilot, and that was my goal. That got me out of bed just on fire every morning. It really did. And then, you know, sort of 10, 15 years later, I became an airline pilot. And then I sort of got lost, and I couldn't put my finger on it. And what it was is I didn't have a goal that I was looking forward to. So I started plucking random goals out of thin air. Sorry, dog just barking here. Started plucking random goals out of thin air. And one of them was I was going to run a marathon, and I failed. I didn't even get to the start line. And so then I just took a huge step back, and it wasn't until I realized I wasn't passionate about those two things that things started to make sense. So what I did is I just started letting myself dream, coming up with all these ideas. And what I was doing was, and I realize it now, is I was feeding my funnel, and I was feeding it full of ideas, and then I got more and more ideas, and that's how I found mountaineering, and that's I found my passion. And once you've found your passion, then you're basically you're off. You know, it's really easy to find that passion and that motivation.
Yes, well, look, I've never, fortunately, I think, had that desire to climb Everest, but I've always wanted to know what it's like. Did you feel absolutely exhilarated when you got to the top?
No. When I got to the top of Everest, there was no one there because there was a bit of a storm in the night and it spread people out and a lot of people turned around. But I was very humble to be standing there, and I was very, very scared because probably for maybe 15 hours you've been pushing, well, sorry, for 10 hours you've been pushing yourself past what you think is a safe limit. So you're way outside your comfort zone. I knew the most dangerous part was coming down. Standing on the top wasn't a revelation and, you know, just a big celebration. It was get some photographs, have a look around, and then come down as quick as I can safely. So looking back on it, yeah, that was sort of when I got off the mountain and I was safe. Yeah, I looked back on it, it was pretty, it just seemed actually quite incredible what human beings can do, not what I did, what human beings can do, because Everest is just extremely difficult.
Well, as you mentioned then, it was a bit unusual because we're hearing a lot these days about the crowds and having to wait to actually do that last little bit to get on the top. So what do you think about the regulation of climbing Everest these days?
Well, I mean, Nepal is a very poor country, and its biggest income is from, you know, selling permits for Everest. So, you know, the other thing is it's such a small weather window. I mean, people don't realise, I think, that there's only probably 14 days a year that you can actually climb it. So occasionally everybody tries to climb it all at once, especially if the weather's been bad, which has obviously happened a couple of times. I don't know, all the good operators, from what I heard from different people, weren't actually climbing that day. They were just, there were other operators that just wanted to try and get their clients up. I know, you know, personal friends of mine climbed this year, they were long gone before those queues ever happened. So I think it's going to happen again. But, you know, people dying, waiting in a queue, that's crazy. It really is.
Is it something like rock climbing? I mean, to climb Everest, all these other mountains that you've done. Is it recommended if you're scared of heights?
No, because I'm scared of heights. A friend of mine said to me, he goes, and he's a world-class climber, and he said, if you're not scared of heights, you don't have any respect for it. Being scared of heights is what keeps you alive, and you learn to deal with it. And so you learn to deal with that. You know, things like rock climbing, it's very, you know, it's a safe sport. You know, you don't take heaps and heaps of risks. You put on your protective gear, or you climb bolted climbs, or a top rope, or all things like that, and you know, it reduces the risks a lot. You know, it's not like the TV program Free Solo where you're climbing without ropes. So, you know, from rock climbing, it's very safe. From mountaineering, well, avalanche and crevasse fall, you know, those are risks which you can mitigate to a certain extent, but at the same time, you've got to... You've got to be prepared to take some risk as well in the mountains, especially with avalanche. You can't really predict that 100%.
And we're speaking today with Mike Allsop, who is the author of a new book called High Adventure. The adventure doesn't end when you become a dad. And when you have a look at the book, you'll see a great photo of Mike and his daughter at base camp of Mount Everest. So that'll give you an idea of some of the things that are covered in this great book. I guess that brings me to the big question. Why do you climb mountains at all, Mike?
Well, when I was younger, before I had kids, it was a challenge. It was my passion. And basically, I was climbing bigger and bigger mountains. I mean, Everest was the pinnacle of that. But I just fell in love with mountaineering. There's no one around. It's beautiful and peaceful. The amount of work and effort is just huge you have to put into it. It's like a really big, each mountain's a huge goal and a huge project, and it's extremely satisfying. It's absolutely fantastic. And then when I went to the Himalayas, I just fell in love with the Himalayas. It was just an incredible place, and the Sherpa people and the Nepalese and Nepal itself. And so I wanted to involve my children. So when I finished climbing Everest, I realized my kids need a dad more than I need to go and take big risks on mountains. So I stopped climbing, alpine climbing, and still rock climb. That's a lot safer. And I take my children into the Himalaya. We don't go into the mountains, so to speak, like on the snow and crevasses. We actually just trek to base camp or along the little villages along the way. And we sort of develop a bit of history there, which is fantastic. Kids absolutely love it.
Yeah, and once again, they love just having that one-on-one time, I guess. That's all a big part of it.
It is, absolutely.
And another big question I want to ask you, is there really a Yeti up there in those mountains?
Now this is getting controversial. I've been around the Sherpa for 15, 20 years, and there is something in the mountains that they call a Yeti. And when I asked Lama Gershi about it, he'd been there since 1953, and I said to him, is there such thing as a Yeti? And he started talking to his wife, and they started having a bit of an argument. And I asked his son to translate what they were saying. And he said, Dad is saying the Yeti attacked Mum's friend at the back door 10 years ago, and Mum is saying, no, it's only 5 years ago. So whether there's some really good science that's come back around the Yeti, and they've had some really good DNA samples of the thing, and it's now believed, and the Western scientists believe it is a hybrid bear that stands on its back legs. But it's called a Yeti.
Okay, so there's something out there. And you just mentioned then...
I was going to say, without a doubt. There's something out there without a doubt. You go there and you talk to the Sherpas, and if they talk to you about it, but they don't, because they're very superstitious about it. Every time they see it, every time they see the footprints, somebody in their family gets sick or dies, so they don't like talking about it. So it's taken me a long time to actually get them to open up.
And you mentioned then Lama Geshe, who did have an enormous influence on you. I wonder, this might have perhaps been a father figure for you, but he even went to the extent of naming your child, didn't he?
Well, he did. He offered to name my unborn child. He knew Dylan was going to be a boy, and I don't know how he knew that, because Wendy was only 6 weeks pregnant. We didn't even know, and he did. Yeah, he was a Buddhist leader, and I think he just taught me to reflect better on myself and just look at myself and believe in the good in people as well and the good in myself.
Yeah, he sounds like an extraordinary man, and you were privileged enough to go to his funeral and participate with all the locals in venerating Lama Geshe.
Yeah, that was really sad. I was going to Nepal and I went a couple of weeks early, and I went to his funeral to pay my respects. And I was the only Westerner of there, and there was 200 Sherpa from the village sitting on the side of a mountain saying goodbye to him. And as he was being cremated in his cremation chamber, there was five huge Himalayan eagles flying over the ceremony, which is fantastic for the Sherpa. So they believe that he's gone to this next life.
Now, you've faced all these dangers, and you've overcome your fears, but you also had a fear of marriage when you met Wendy. I'm just wondering why you felt like that.
Well, I knew a lot of people that had got married and had been divorced, and coming from a broken home myself, I was very worried about getting married. I was worried that once I got married, had children, my life would change and I wouldn't be able to go on adventures and I wouldn't be able to do anything, and I'd just be coming home and doing as I'm told, which is far from what it actually, the reality, it really was. And so, that was just some limiting beliefs on my part, and I was probably, what's the best word for it, a bit naive, but things worked out really well. They really did. And I talk about that in the book. I talk about being worried about getting tied and settled down, worried about having children. And for the first 4 or 5 years, you can't really... I mean, we still have adventures, but the adventures are walking around the rocks at the beach, finding crabs, or, building a little go-kart with a three- or a four-year-old, something, small adventures like that. You can't take, the kids, super young away. And then when they turn 7, that's when I took them into the Himalayas, and it worked really well.
Yes, I guess that's a big theme of the book. And you talk at one stage of the toll that your mountain climbing put on your relationship, but you also mentioned that you hadn't showered for a couple of months when you caught up with Wendy, so perhaps that gives some understanding.
I hadn't. I was quite proud of the fact that I hadn't had a shower for, I think, 6 weeks. I'd rushed back to the hotel and sort of had a pretty quick shower. But Wendy may be going to have another shower or longer.
Well, there's a good influence of your wife, I'm sure. You mentioned the airport, that Lukla Airport, where you have to take off if you're going to climb Everest. And I'm just wondering, with the limitations of that airport and the dangers, was it perhaps worse for you as a pilot that you knew what the pilots were facing?
Absolutely. So I would, every time I go there, if there's a storm or there's thunderstorms or there's, stuff like that, I just go the next day. You can swap your ticket around really easy. I just go the next day. Or I jump in a helicopter and, for another couple hundred dollars, you can actually cash your ticket in and just get into a helicopter. So I'm quite cautious about that flight. That's probably the most dangerous part of it. But in reality, they've been flying in there for a long, long time, and they've had a couple of crashes, but they haven't had a crash for a while of a passenger plane with passengers on board. There was one probably this season, actually, that ran off the runway and hit a helicopter. That was very sad, and a couple of people got killed there. But generally, it's quite safe.
Now, we're speaking today with Mike Allsop, who is the author of High Adventure. The adventure doesn't end when you become a dad. Mike, at this stage of the program, we ask our guests if they'd like to pick a song. Would you like to tell us which one you picked and perhaps why you picked it?
Well, I picked Jimmy Barnes' Working Class Man because, when I was a teen, I loved that song because, it was about a song about working hard, not burning bridges, all that sort of stuff. And I actually sung it to my children as a lullaby to send them to sleep, believe it or not.
Great. I don't know whether Jimmy Barnes would be happy or sad about that, but that's a great...
They can sing it. If it comes on the radio, we turn the radio up even now as a 13, 15 and 17-year-old, and we sing it as loud as we can and as proud as we can.
Denim in his veins. Whoa,
And that was Working Class Man by Jimmy Barnes, which was especially chosen for us today by our guest, Mike Allsop. So, Mike, yes, the big theme of your book is about the kids and setting adventures. They had the chance when they were 7, and then they had the chance when they were 14. It's a little bit like that TV show 7 Up, I think. You know, they come back every 7 years and find out what's happening.
Yeah, I don't know why I've got a thing with the number 7. It's quite funny.
And so they've done 7 and 14, although two of them jumped the gun on the 14. But have you got something planned for 21 as well?
Well, I don't, but they do. I think Wendy and I are going to go, and we renew our wedding vows every sort of 10 years. And we did it in Fiji, just on the beach, on a local beach, just with the local community. We asked them if we could just get married at their village, which is really special. And I think the oldest thinks he wants us to go and renew our vows in Las Vegas.
Yeah.
So,
with Elvis as the minister.
At the Elvis Chapel. Yeah. Yes. Wants us to go.
Oh, that's great. So look, a big question, but as I say, it is a theme of the book. What does being a dad mean to you?
What does being a dad mean to me? I'm really, really firm on the belief that children need a father. They don't need to be a friend. They don't need a friend at that stage. And it's a fine line, and I don't want to try and confuse it in any way. I can be their friend later on when they're in their 20s, but when they're young, I think children need a strong father figure, and that's what I aim to be for my kids, really, personally.
Yes, I like the way you say that you don't really, you shouldn't be a friend when you're a parent. People shouldn't be afraid to be a parent. So that means setting boundaries, and it means enforcing a bit of discipline, not physical discipline, but just discipline, and with those boundaries. And you know, I think the evidence is there with the way your children have grown up.
Well, absolutely, and especially, you know, other thing where if there's any issues, I make sure we address them when they're small, you know, when they're tiny issues, so that I'm not having a argument with a 16 or 17 year old that's wanting to drive a car. You know what I mean? So I try and make sure that we have the small arguments about respect when they're a lot smaller, or discipline, or trying hard, or that sort of stuff. When they're smaller, so when they've grown up, it's already instilled in them. Is what I try and do.
With a lot of parents having problems with moody and grumpy children, I liked your solution, which was, let's go on an adventure. But I guess there are some rules for the types of adventures that you pick.
Yeah, so there's three rules. It has to be outside the limits of what you think is possible for them. It has to be safe, so it has to have Wendy's approval, and it has to be good for a community. It has to be good for someone else. Now, Kilimanjaro for teenagers, 14 is probably the youngest. I'd take a teenager up there. On a 7-day climb, I wouldn't go any sooner than that or any quicker than that. It's a fantastic place because, I tell you what, there's no moody teenagers. Well, and Nepal is the same. You know, they might be moody getting on the airplane and flying up to Nepal, but even halfway through that, they're fantastic. And then it's just pure excitement for them. You know, and Nepal is such a Kathmandu, and it's sensory overload as soon as you get there. And it's incredible, absolutely incredible. And for them, the only time they want the internet is to take some photographs and upload them to their mates, and then they're just back out doing stuff. It's really neat. There's no moody teenagers on an adventure, I tell you.
We've been speaking with Mike Alsop, who is the author of this new book, High Adventure, The Adventure Doesn't End When You Become a Dad. And there is so much in this book. There's fascinating stories of adventures, of climbing Everest, of running marathons. And there's also a wealth of parenting advice, which is very timely, I think, at the moment. So make sure you watch out for that striking photo on the cover. So it really just remains for me now to thank Mike. Mike, thank you very much for being a guest on Dad's on the Air.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you very much for having me.
And look, we'd love to hear from any of our listeners too. You can go to our website, dadsontheair.com.au, send us an email, and we'll be in touch. If you'd like to listen to this show again or any of our shows, go to our website, dadsontheair.com.au, and you can follow us on Facebook or Twitter. And we'll be back next week with another show on Dad's on the Air.